Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Eugenia Zuckerman. Eugenia, of course, is the new music director of Clarion Concerts in Columbia County's Leaf Peeper Concerts and has been hailed by the press as one of the finest flutists in our time. Internationally renowned as a recitalist and a soloist, Eugenia also continues with the dramatic schedule as a writer, artistic director, television journalist, arts administrator, educator, and internet entrepreneur. Artistic director of the Bravo Vale Valley Music Festival from 1998 through 2010. She was instrumental in bringing the New York Philharmonic, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the Dallas Symphony to the festival for extended residencies each summer. An Emmy-nominated arts correspondent for more than 350 profiles of artists, musicians, theater, and dance on CBS TV News Sunday Morning. She's continued her role as an arts journalist by creating video blogs for many music conservatories and organizations in partnership with MusicalAmerica.com. A new video blog, NoteEndedEndeavors.com, was launched by Ms. Zuckerman, Dr. Emily Andrasek-Peterson, and Dr. Eric Peterson in September 2014. An archive of accomplished ideas, NoteEndeavors.com, helped musicians, both emerging and veteran, learn how to successfully create their own opportunities. The video blog has an avid following. Ms. Zuckerman's list of writing credits includes two novels, two nonfiction books, screenplays and articles, and book reviews in such prominent periodicals as the New York Times, the Washington Post, Esquire, and Vogue. Born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, educated at Barnard College and the Juilliard School, Eugenia makes her home in New York City and in Ankrumdale, New York, where she shares a small farm with her husband and old friend, broadcaster Richard Novick, two horses, one dog, and a crazy cat named Lulu. Welcome, Eugenia Zuckerman.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's very impressive to have you here and to read these credits. So I have a first question that will define our interview, and I hope you don't mind it. It may be fresh. Is it flutist or flautist?
You know, if you're German, you say flautist because that's the German pronunciation. If you're English, you say flautist.
Oh.
I say I flaunt my flute.
So when did you pick the instrument up for the first time?
It was one of these stories of being in a public school where music was really important.
In Boston?
Actually, in West Hartford, Connecticut. Oh. We had moved from Cambridge. And a group of instrumentalists from the Hartford Symphony came to demonstrate their instruments. I was 10 years old. I heard the flute. I was literally enchanted, and I ran home, and I said, I have to play the flute. And in those days, there was money to rent a flute, to get a teacher in the school system.
Yeah.
So I was a very lucky recipient of that wonderful time when we cared about the arts
for children. Did your parents have any money?
My parents were okay. They were not wealthy, but
they
were great. My father was an inventor. When he died, he had more than 500 worldwide patents.
Wow.
And he was very important during World War II because he was the person who developed sonar to be able to scan the circle, and he was 22 years old.
Whoa.
So, and my mother was a dancer with Martha Graham and the first woman to be admitted to City College School of Engineering. So I had an interesting upbringing, I'll tell you that.
I would say you did. So let's just get some of the biography out of the way. Where did you go to college?
I went to Barnard College. I was quite unsure what path I wanted to take. I wanted to be an actress, and I wanted to be a writer, etc. And I was playing the flute, and I was studying with Julius Baker, who was the first flutist of the New York Philharmonic. And he said to me one day, you know, you have the stuff to be a really fine flutist, but won't happen if you stay at a liberal arts college. Come to Juilliard. You'll learn the flute. You'll play in an orchestra, and you'll write the All-American novel. And I liked the game plan. So I went to my parents, and after 2 years at Barnard, they allowed me to switch to the Juilliard School, which I did.
And what's the difference in your memory between the Barnard students and the Juilliard students?
They were like night and day. When you went to a liberal arts school, you were trying a little of this. Maybe I'll do geography. Maybe I'll do French. Maybe I'll do other things. There were not many people who were very driven. And I got to Juilliard, and everybody not only wanted to be good at their instrument, they wanted to be the best in the world. and they were motivated, and they were competitive. And it was totally different. It was like suddenly being pushed into an arena of people who were in many ways like 30-year-olds. From being 18, I suddenly was put in a world where I went to school with Misha Dichter, the pianist, Jimmy Levine was still around, Lynn Harrell, and of course Pinchas Zukerman, who I married early on.
So let me go back to this. When you said driven and competitive, did that competition ever take an ugly side to it? In other words, was it cutthroat?
Quietly cutthroat. But I was very lucky because I did very well and I became the first flutist of the first orchestra. And so I didn't feel the competition so much. But I think also it was a strange mix of very collegial but also competitive. And I think Juilliard has changed. This is when we went to Juilliard, it was uptown and it had asbestos falling from the ceilings, et cetera. And now it's in a beautiful Lincoln Center, et cetera. And
of course.
I think
maybe it's lost something as a result.
I don't know.
I'm just teasing.
There are fantastic kids coming out of there.
There are.
And that's one of the reasons that I started the video blog called Noted Endeavors. Because one of the things my colleague, Emily Ondracek Peterson, discovered doing her 500-page thesis for her doctorate was that kids at the conservatories felt that they didn't get enough about learning how to create their own opportunities. Because, as you know, the world of classical music is very competitive, but there are less and less opportunities for kids to go into an orchestra. I mean, every time there's a flute opening, if it's Oshkosh, 500 flutists
really
want to be
really
there. Yeah.
You know, we have a wonderful relationship with the Boston Symphony, and we play every Boston Symphony concert, as you know, I'm sure, as an Ankrumdale listener. And we go out to Tanglewood and we talk to them, to all the greats and the near greats, and to Ellen Heistein, and you get the idea that there are so many problems impinging on classical music today. You know, in Japan, classical music is flourishing.
And in China.
Yeah, in China. Not so much here. You have to really compete in order to do it. What do you think the basis of that is?
Well, I think it's a very interesting time. Yeah, the internet changed things for all of us. And I think you can look at it in a negative way or a positive way. I think in a way we live at a time that was as inventive as the time when we suddenly had a printing press. That's kind of my analogy. And things were up in the air. And I think it's the same right now. But I remain very optimistic and positive because I see signs of kids who never knew anything about classical music, and they can Google something that they heard on TV the night before and say, that was cool music. What was it? It was on, you know,
The Lone Ranger.
Something like that. And they will then want to explore more. I think that the opportunities to go spelunkering musically in the internet actually are bringing some young people in. I think also world music didn't happen until, 15 years ago?
Mm.
No one was studying it. Now many schools like Wesleyan have these fabulous world music programs. But I think it's possibly that. Also, I think orchestras, to go to a symphony concert costs a fortune, at least $60. And if you're, say, a young couple with a child at home, you know, you have to pay the babysitter, you have to pay the parking, what if you want dinner, etc. And it's tremendously expensive.
You can listen on WAMC, of course.
Yes, you can.
Not exactly the same.
Sometimes it's nice to be in the hall and see the players and hear it.
Right, right. What does it feel like to be a soloist? Our very good friend at the Boston Symphony managed to score us a couple of tickets, my wife and I, in which we sat right in front of Joshua Bell and in front of Yo-Yo a different night. And you see these guys up front and really close in the concentration, and I know you have that too. What's it like to be standing up there with an orchestra behind you and a conductor next to you?
I think it's different for everyone. I know that my first husband, Pinchas Zukerman, did not get nervous, and I don't think he still does get nervous. I mean, I don't think he does. There are other people who are exceptionally nervous beforehand, and I'm one of them. I've never quite conquered my fear. And I think, for me, it's like wild horses. Some days they're tame, and some days they're not. I have been sometimes more nervous playing a concerto in some very small town where there's really probably no critic going to come, and I'm just nervous. I think what everyone who is a soloist shares in common is the drive to do one's best. And to communicate, of course, to the audience. That's key, too. But I think it's your own sense of being able to do your best. And I know the hero of my first novel was a pianist, and he disappears on page one, and you find out all about what his life has been like. And he reads a newspaper one day after a concert, and he reads it, and he feels that he has played horribly, and he says, "Trust a critic to praise you for the one concert you're ashamed of."
What do you think about critics? Let's talk about that for a minute. It's one of my favorite subjects, so why not? You know, the old saying, those who can do and those who can't teach and all the rest of it. It's just, it's unfair. But nevertheless, critics or those who can't become critics.
Well, you know, I think that there are some critics who are so well-educated and they have very good taste, etc. But there's something to me about criticizing. I wish they were called something else, listeners. And so it could be just have very much the sense that it's their own point of view and that probably a lot of people don't agree with it. Sometimes I feel that there are critics who have to show off that they know what the second theme was and that it didn't work so well with the, you know, whatever. But there are some that I really respect. And I'm always excited when I read a positive review, and especially when I agree with it. I think there are so few critics left that are writing in newspapers, and there are so few people that are reading newspapers, but there are a lot of blogs. So there are so many opinions out there. And as I talk to my musician friends, I find that they are all saying, it doesn't matter because everybody will write about it and there will be 5,000 different points of view.
I don't know. I live in the Berkshires, so I don't want to get into this particular gripe of mine. But, you know, we have one newspaper, really, and then we have one major newspaper for the place, and we have a guy, who writes, but he's also has other functions on the paper. But the great thing about him, even though I disagree with him a lot, is that the concert is over. The critics I worry about are the critics who come to the first night of a wonderful play in the Berkshires and who ruin it for everybody by saying, this place stinks, basically.
Right. And
then, based on that one newspaper area, but concerts aren't like that. You say, okay, the flute player hit a high C that wasn't quite right or whatever, mm-hmm.
Well, I agree with you. It's like saying, the ballerina can't dance. But critics for classical music are different than critics for anything else. I think they are generally less enthusiastic. I love to read the reviews of singer-songwriter, evenings, cabaret, because they're always excited. I love to read the art reviews in the New York Times because the viewers are always finding something interesting to say. The critics, those art critics.
You have a number of times today. You open the door, counselors, they say on Law and Order. And you've mentioned your ex-husband, Pinchas Zukerman, and you married him. And then, there were those people who probably uncharitably said, well, she's Mrs. Zukerman. But then you went on to become world famous. I would watch you on the CBS Sunday Morning and wonderful, wonderful pieces that you did there and all of that. And so there was more equality between the two people, even though you may have not still been married. What did you ever feel that you had achieved that threshold, gotten over being Mrs. and started being equal?
Well, I never felt lesser, but I did feel that I could sort of spread my wings more as someone who was not Mrs. Zukerman. But look, we were very young. Pinky was 19 when we married. I think I was 21. And we have fabulous children, we have fabulous grandchildren, and we're friends. And that is what matters. And I admire him so much. My husband, Dick Novick, and I always go to his concerts at Tanglewood.
Wonderful.
And we have a great time. So that's really
there's no
nice
animus.
Thing. No, not anymore. I think the beginning of anyone's divorce, it's not a picnic.
No.
But there it was. And we are very friendly.
That's wonderful. Tell us a little about your kids.
I have two daughters, Ariana Zuckerman and Natalia Zuckerman. Ariana is an opera singer, and Natalia is a singer-songwriter and a painter. And they're both very successful, and they're both absolutely wonderful. My older daughter just went through 10 months of breast cancer, and she was very public about it. It was a nightmare. She had two babies and lots of surgeries, ending with a double mastectomy and a total reconstruction. 6 weeks later, she was singing in Cincinnati. Mm. So she really taught me a great deal about adversity. And that is that really it is so much your attitude that matters. Because she said, I am going to beat this. And of course, with two babies, you want to. But I also was very proud of her for the way she openly spoke about it. Because a lot of people in the world, the vocal world, say or have said about women who have had breast cancer, well, we can't hire her because probably her voice is gone. And Ariana was really lucky because she was intubated for 13 hours, you know, something down the throat for 13 hours. And her voice, I think, is even better and richer. And so she's doing everything, being a great mother and continuing her career. And Natalia is doing her singer-songwriting all over the place and doing murals. And I so admire my daughters. I have to say they teach me a lot always.
How important are our children? I have them. I'm proud of them. We have now a grandchild. With all of your accomplishments in life, Eugenia Zuckerman, and they are incredible, how do we value our kids next to our careers?
For me, they come first. They have always come first. And if I'm proud of one thing, I'm proud of the relationship that I've always had with them. Their teen years were relatively smooth when I look at other families.
And you raised them in New York City?
Yes. They traveled all over the world with Pinky and with me. And they're unspoiled. They're very giving. They're very loyal. They went to the Bank Street School in New York City.
And my mother actually taught there.
Oh, wow.
She taught a course there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it was the best thing we ever did because that is a school in which really, communication with other children was so important. And if you were in the 3-4s, you went and took care of kids who were younger than you.
In the 1-2s.
Yeah, in the 1-2s. And it was an extraordinary thing. And my daughters still have their best friends from the time they were 4.
Oh, that's great.
And so, you know, schooling is enormously important. One of my daughters went to the Dalton School. My younger daughter went to Fieldston, and they had great educations. Ariana went on to Brown, Natalia went on to Oberlin, and they were very lucky. They had great educations, and they knew what they wanted to do early on. So I was given really good package. I didn't have to say, you know, come on, think about what you want to do.
And what about the relationship with the grandchildren now? What's that like? I mean, our young man is 15 months old right now, and we watch him every day, and we watch how he changes from week to week and day to day. It's amazing.
Oh, it's heaven. It's just heaven. I have two granddaughters. Veronica Mia is going to be 4 in a few weeks, and Tabitha Lily is 18 months old. They were just up in the country with us. And they saw the horses and the dogs, and they hadn't been able to touch a horse before or feed a horse before. And we had the absolutely best time. We have a pool, so we went swimming with them. We took them all sorts of places. And it's just heaven. I think we should never be parents. We should just be grandparents.
Right.
That's all.
It's good when they come, and it's not so bad when they go.
Well, I feel sad when they go. And
they
live in, they don't live near me, so it's hard to, I mean, Washington, D.C. is not that far away, but it's a schlep.
No, it is.
And, but it's worth it. I go as often as I can, and I think having grandchildren is such a blessing.
We are talking to the great artist Eugenia Zuckerman, and we're very fortunate to have her here. But tell us about the Leaf Peepers concerts.
You know, the Leaf Peepers is an extraordinary organization. It's the oldest, longest-running, continuously performing nonprofit chamber music group in Columbia County. And it was founded by an extraordinary musicologist named Newell Jenkins, who went to Italy and brought back rare Baroque manuscripts. He started Clarion Concerts in, I think, 1982. And he had a series in New York City and up here. And when he died, Sanford Allen, the wonderful violinist who was with the New York Philharmonic and he's a soloist, took over and started the Leaf Peeper series. And that, of course, is during the fall up in this area where everything is so beautiful. And there have been four concerts in the fall, two in September, two in October. So when I took over, I wanted to make sure that I could continue some of the really important work that I think Sanford has done. And a lot of that is that he is a great advocate of contemporary music. And the organization makes a real point of commissioning new work. So I decided that I wanted to create my very first season in a way that would follow that. So I am very happy that our programs will include five pieces by contemporary composers as well as classical favorites and jazz, Baroque, Romantic, and exotic sounds of the Middle East. And I really am so thrilled that so many of my fabulous musical friends are coming to join me, especially the first concert is Saturday, September 12th at 7:30 at Our Lady of Hope Church in Copaic Falls. Beautiful church.
It is. It's not too big either.
No, it's not. And we are, I have entitled this concert Fountains of Fine Sound because it features a piece by the Iranian composer Behzad Ranjbaran called Fountains of Fine. And it's a powerful work that he wrote in 2008. And we also commissioned David Mancini, whose work runs the gamut of classical to jazz. And he wrote a beautiful piece called The Journey for String Quartet. And there will be music by Mozart, Schubert, and Dohnányi. And I'm thrilled that Gary Levinson, who is associate concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony, is coming. Nokutula Nguyenyama, who is a beautiful violist, is coming from out in the West. And Suren Bagratuni is coming from Michigan. So people are flying in to play up in the woods with the beautiful leaf peepers.
Well, it is a beautiful spot, I have to tell you right now. It's right up there near Bashbish Falls. It's quite wonderful. Let me ask you this, Eugenia Zuckerman. It costs money to put these things on, doesn't it?
It does. We are a nonprofit organization, and all of the money really goes to paying the artists.
So who gives you the money?
We have donations, and we have done a few benefits. I did one benefit this May, and it was sold out in 2 weeks.
Where was that?
It was extraordinary. It was in the private home of a great friend of music whose name is Dr. Richard Collins. And he let us use his beautiful space, which has a wonderful piano in it. And Christopher O'Reilly, who is an NPR star and my great friend, came and played with Eddie Aaron, who's a great cellist, and myself and Tessa Lark, who's a beautiful violinist. And they did everything from Piazzolla to Brahms trio with clarinet. So it was a lovely event, and we raised a lot of money. And that's what we do. We give back. We pay our players as well as we can. We would love to be able to pay them more. And part of our mission also is to do outreach so that there are ways in which we can bring people in without their paying much money. And our tickets are only $25 each. And second concert will be in St. James Church in Chatham, New York, another beautiful church. And this one I've called Love and Chaos. The songs of love and loss will be sung by my daughter, Ariana Zuckerman, and the lovely mezzo-soprano Heather Johnson. And the pianist will be Giovanni Reggioli, who is a great vocal accompanist. And after intermission, the chaos part is the Rite of Spring. Stravinsky wrote the Rite of Spring for the first time and published it for piano, four hands. And I have two pianists who play this. It just knocks your breath out of you. They are Ron Donk and Soyen Kate Lee. Both of them are international prize winners, and they are coming to play this extraordinary piece.
So let me ask you this. This takes a great deal of work on your part, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, I will say.
Well, so you're really being very charitable. I mean, you know, you're a very famous person. You can give concerts. You're greatly in demand. And yet there's something in you that says, okay, this is worth doing.
Well, it's time to give back. I think you come of a certain age and you say, I want to do what I can do. 13 years, I was the artistic director of a pretty big festival, and that was wonderful. This is a very different thing. It's building something, and it's giving something back to the communities. There's so many music lovers all over the place, and I find that our audiences range from farmers to painters to business people, and particularly during the fall, people like to come up and visit, etc. And my board of directors are all volunteer as well. So we are very busy trying to get everything done. And our third concert, we are reaching out to Kinderhook, New York. Our mandate is really Columbia County, but also the regions beyond it. And there is a beautiful Reformed Dutch church in Kinderhook with a great organ. And the great organist, harpsichordist, pianist, Anthony Newman, who I have worked with for 40 years, will play the Kinderhook organ, and he'll play Bach's great toccata, Adagio, and Fugue. And this will be an all-Baroque concert, which we do yearly, and it is in honor of the founder, Newell Jenkins. So we're going to play Telemann, Bois Mortier, Vivaldi, etc. And the players are Sanford Allen, who is the former head of this organization, Virginia Brewer, fabulous oboist. I'm going to toot my flute. And Raman Ramakrishnan is going to play cello. And that's going to be exciting. And our final concert is on October 24th back at the St. James Church in Chatham, New York, called Angels and Earthly Delights. And the Vaxare String Quartet, young, wonderful, particularly great with contemporary music, they will play a piece by a young, hip, up-and-coming composer, Mohammed Ferouz, a piece called Named Angels. And it's an extraordinary piece that explores the commonalities of the Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Muslimism, and Judaism. And I've heard them play it, and it's haunting. And then Mendelssohn's String Quartet in A minor, which is one of the great pieces. After intermission, they will play a very cool piece by Lou Harrison called Estomp, which is a stomping dance. And then Paul Green, the extraordinary clarinetist, will join the quartet to do Mozart's Clarinet Quintet in A major, which is another, maybe one of my favorite pieces. So those are the four concerts. But as you said, there's so much to do. We have to get the chairs. We have to get move the things around. We have to invite the artists. We have to, in many cases, house the artists. We have to pick them up at the train. There's a lot to do when it's a small organization. And the Leafpaper Board are terrific people. They come from different places and they do different things, but they all love music and they all pitch in, and it's a great group. So as hard as it's been, when I took over, they had a website that wasn't working, so we had to start with a website, etc. And now I think we are definitely in the 21st century and definitely growing, and it's very exciting to be part of it.
So let me change topics for a moment and go back to your television time. You did that for quite a while, right?
I did that for more than 25 years.
Wow.
It never really ended. It's just that the head of the program said that any time we had a classical piece on, people turned off. Yeah. You know, they have a way of calibrating that.
Sure. And, I didn't, by the way. I always loved them.
I knew you didn't. I knew that. But Charles Kuralt was a very special man.
He was.
And our pieces, to begin with, were 12 minutes, 12 uninterrupted.
That's why Sunday morning, that's why that program works on Sunday morning and didn't when they tried it on other days of the week, because it did give some extra time to things, I think.
Right. But by the time I left and there was a new regime and everything, the pieces were some 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So I really don't believe that the audience has a short attention span. I just think it's all about money, you know, get more advertising.
It's all about money, of course.
But in my time there, it was such an absolute honor to be able to interview some of the great artists of our time.
Well, what's it like? I mean, what do you get? You get a producer with you who helps you set the whole thing up? And...
Well, of course, when I started, it was reel to reel, so that took longer to edit, etc. But when Charles Kuralt was the head, I would meet with him or Shad Northfield, who was the producer, a very, very charismatic and famous TV guy. He knew a lot about music, and I knew all the players. So I interviewed Yo-Yo and Manny X when they were just starting out. And I was able to tap into the people that I knew. And I mean, some of the people that I worked with, I sometimes think about it and realize, wow, that was really quite something. I interviewed Bryn Terfel, the great baritone, when he was just starting out. I interviewed Paul McCartney when he wrote the Liverpool Oratorio.
How was that?
It's a wonderful piece.
Well, I don't even mean the piece. How was Paul McCartney as a subject?
Very sexy. Very adorable. Very nice. Very complimentary. And we had a really nice conversation. You know, he doesn't write music. He doesn't know how to notate music. But his ear is just...
Neither did Irving Berlin, by the way. He had this piano, which he would pump it up or whatever. I mean, a lot of these people are geniuses without knowing notation.
Right, like Hans Zimmer, also the film writer. Jesse Norman, Dmitri Forstovsky, Roberta Peters, Leontine Price, Renata Scotto, Judy Collins. And to me, I would always walk away feeling that I was the luckiest person in the world to have been in the presence of these people who love what they do. And somehow I came away inspired every single time.
Did they ever tell you that you couldn't interview somebody?
No.
I mean, from a political point of view, I'm thinking of Pete Seeger or somebody like that.
No, there were no politics in the art area. Mm-hmm. I have to say that was a wonderful thing. I interviewed Sir George Schulte, Zubin Mehta, James DePriest, Charles Dutoit. You know, composers too. Aaron Copland.
Really?
He was my very first interview.
Wow.
And it was trial by fire because I had a producer who was not too happy to have a rookie. And so he said to me, you know, we're going to go interview him. And when we went to his house, he was unfortunately already beginning to be lost in his dementia. And he had a lot of people around him. And this producer said to me, here's what you're going to ask him. You're going to tell him that he did a musical portrait of a composer and you want to know why that happened and you want to know this about him and that about him and you want to ask him to play this musical portrait. And I, as a musician, said, you know, he's a very old man and he's not too well and I don't feel that I... He said, you ask him. So I get there and I sit in front of the great Aaron Copland and he says to me, who are you and why are you here? So I tell him, and he nods, and we begin the interview, and I say, you did a musical portrait of this composer. Can you play it for us? He said, no, I didn't. Then I asked the next question, you know, and he just sat there and then leaned forward and said, who are you and why are you here?
Yeah.
But then one day, I asked him about his experience in Paris because, you know, he studied in Paris and he was there. And he said, I was walking down the Rue Saint-Honoré and who should I see but the great so-and-so? And we stopped and he said to and I said to him, you need to write an organ symphony. And Copland went on to be very expansive with this story and then he sank back and was gone again. But I will never forget what that was like to be in the presence of someone who was so great and trying so hard. And then there was Lily Krauss, one of the great pianists of our time, was imprisoned in Japan as a spy. And she was taken from her family and put into hard labor with her hands. And then she was in solitary confinement in a pit for a period of time. And her hands were broken, and she said that the only thing that got her through this horrible period of her life was practicing in her head and hearing music in her head. And she went through all 25 Mozart piano concertos in her head throughout the entire experience, which I think lasted 2 years. I caught up with her in a nursing home somewhere in the Carolinas. And she was still extremely acute and right there. She had no dementia problems whatsoever. And she was in her 80s. And she was thrilled to be talking about her life. And, you know, when she told this story about being so abused during the war, and she came back to record the 25 Mozart concerti.
How did it come to be, Eugenia, that she was imprisoned by the Japanese? Was she living there or what happened?
Her husband was, I'm not sure I'm going to get this story right, but for some reason, she and her husband left Switzerland, went to England, and the British decided that she could be an emissary for them if they went to the Far East for some reason. Or I think they went to the Far East. I can't remember what the real reason was. It had to do with her personal safety, and then she was picked up as a spy, which made no sense whatsoever, taken from her husband and children. I think her husband may have been part Jewish, and that was part of the reason. Who knows? But whatever it was, she was arrested as a spy and taken into a labor camp. And so when she was out of prison, came to the United States, she was the very first woman, certainly, and maybe the very first pianist, to record all 25 Mozart piano concerti on film. And it's still there. It's still, you can still see it. And when I asked her, what was it that allowed you to come out of such a horrible situation with such an open and positive attitude? And she said it was the music. It was hearing the music. I did not let it crush me. And I thought that was just amazing that she stayed positive through that whole time.
Amazing. That's a great story. So when you're done with all of these television things, did you miss it?
Yes and no. It's labor intensive, a lot of travel, and I was already traveling a lot for my concerts. Yeah. And I, of course, missed it. And I said to a friend of mine who was a producer there, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, get off the Titanic and get in the lifeboat, the internet. And my daughters were saying to me, you can do a video blog. That's easy to do. So I was very fortunate. I decided that I would create something called Classical Genie, which is my nickname. And I was lucky that I was able to talk some people into letting me do video blogs. Well, one of the first people was Bob Sirota, who was the head of the Manhattan School. And I did a whole series of interviews, which they used for purposes of public relations. I then did a video blog for Tanglewood, for the Boston Symphony. It was something like 40 segments with text as well. And I'm friends with all of the people at Tanglewood, and that was a great experience. They were very supportive. And I did video blog also for the Verbier Festival. I did two video blogs for the Verbier Festival because I went to play there. And the very first blog was pretty much about how do you get yourself ready to go play in one of the most prestigious festivals in the world for the first time when you don't know anyone and the repertoire is so hard. I was doing the camera concert of Schoenberg with players I didn't know. And so that for me was a big stretch to be able to do that. And I had to ask people to hold the camera. I didn't really know what I was doing, but that came out so well that Verbier asked me to do another video blog of their summer, of their 20th anniversary, which I did, and I also performed there too. And after that, the idea came to me with my friend Emily Ondrejczyk Peterson and her husband Eric Peterson. Such bright, such interesting young people. She did a 500-page thesis about what conservatory-trained string players felt they did not get at the conservatory. And it was a lot they felt that they didn't get.
Can you sum it up in a line?
How to make your own opportunities and how to follow through so that your idea is achieved and achievable. So one of the things that we did was to just see what would happen if we asked people step by step how it was and what they did to create their own opportunities. Noted Endeavors is an archive of achieved ideas, and my partners in this are two young players who play the Vaxari String Quartet, And Emily Ondracek-Peterson did a 500-page thesis for her doctorate about what conservatory-trained string players felt they did not get at college. And they all felt that a lot of things were lacking, like business knowledge and how to create their own opportunities. So we decided finally that we were going to do this video blog. And they were always in partnership, by the way, with MusicalAmerica.com. So NotedEndeavors.com is also a website on its own, but it also is posted by MusicalAmerica.com, which is one of the biggest purveyors of classical music information actually in the world. So we asked a lot of hip young people, how did they do what they did? For example, Eliran Avni has something called Shuffle. It's a concert that is a unique idea of having the audience choose the pieces from a menu, which became very popular. Daniel Bernard Rumain, who is an extraordinary hipster and hopster and classical musician and teacher, he has created so many things that people are doing. We have interviewed people from Eighth Blackbird, which is a great group that got together and is thriving. The Imani Winds, who are extraordinary. The wonderful string quartet called Ethel, which has been around for some time. But, you know, how did they put it together? How did they make things happen? I interviewed everyone from Matt Heimovitz, Susan Wadsworth about young concert artists, Christian Steiner about Tannery Pond, Joan Tower, composer, Josh Roman, a wonderful cellist, Nico Muley, who's a very extraordinary composer, and about 50 people. And what we are asking them is not just, you know, tell us about you and what you do, but how did you do it? How did you decide to be nonprofit? How did you find your board? Do you have management? If not, why not? How can a young person do what you've done? What is the most important thing to do first? How do you structure your rehearsals? Where do you find rehearsal space? All of these nitty-gritty things which the kids really don't know. So we're finding that we get an awful lot of excited people saying, it's great that you're doing that. So,
did your daughter get all of that at Oberlin when she was at the conservatory?
Oh, gosh, no. She studied guitar at the conservatory, but she then majored in painting because her interest in guitar was for really singing, songwriting. Right. And at that time, it was more classical that they were teaching.
Talk to me, Eugenia Zuckerman, if you will, about teaching itself. So you get students every once in a while who really want to learn from one of the great flute players in the United States, and they come to you. What do you do with them?
Well, I ask them to play for me. And I give them suggestions. I ask them what it is they are trying to do with the piece that they're playing for me. You know, what is the intention? I also really feel that it's so important as a teacher to not be negative. Even if someone comes to you and you think to yourself, this is never going to happen for this person.
But do you ever have to counsel them and say, look, this may never happen for you?
I would never do that because I have learned that you never know, when someone is going to catch fire. Mm. I am very close friends with Daniel Hope, who is an on fire, worldwide famous violinist. I've known him since he was 10. I remember hearing him when he was 10. He had just started the violin. And his parents were not musicians. And I thought, how could this happen for him? Within a few years, this guy was playing like a god. And not only that, he went on not just to be a great violinist, but, you know, he's written books. He has all sorts of organizations. He's worldwide. And, I mean, he's prized everywhere. And he's like my own son. And he's still best friends with my daughter, Ariana, because they met when I played at the Gestad Festival. But, you know, there was someone I thought, I really wonder how this is going to work. And I have seen this too many times to be able to listen to someone who plays badly and to say, give it up. Because you just never know.
But what if they really, really stink?
I have not had people come to me who really, really stink.
They don't make that. They can't get over to get to you.
I really do think that anyone who is making music, playing music, learning music, has some kind of inner sense of when they're ready to go to the next level of teacher. I also think it's urgent that learning music in the school is available to
everybody.
But it
seems to be over, doesn't it? I mean, I went to Joan of Arc Junior High School. I was in the orchestra. I loved it. It was a lifelong love of music for me as a result of Mr. Steiker and what he was able to do there. And the kids can't have that anymore.
I think that there are places where parents and communities are getting together to make sure that kids can learn music. Look at what Midori did in New York City.
Sure.
Look at what there was an organization somewhere on Rhode Island where a string quartet took a falling down storefront with a glass window, started playing their quartet, and kids wandered in. And then they had 200 kids asking for lessons, and then they went to other merchants and got money to do that. There are people who are doing that, and not enough. But it really pains me that we have no artistic aesthetic in our leadership of this country. Not since Jacqueline Kennedy have we had leadership that said, let's present the best of the arts. And that includes rock and roll, and that includes country western. But Jacqueline Kennedy was, I mean, she brought something to this country that has not been replicated.
Did you know her?
I never did meet her.
Talk to me about conductors. I'm always interested in that. How does a soloist size up an orchestra and its conductor? Is it easy or is it hard?
For me, it was and is quite easy. I generally talk to the conductor beforehand. You know, you play for them backstage. You go over tempi, etc. I have yet to meet a conductor who was hard to get along with. Although one, actually, who was a foot stomper. And I think that's about the last thing you ought to do in front of your orchestra is stomp your foot to show that you don't like and sort of, you know, rail at his...
I'm not following. So in other words, he's up there, he's conducting, and he's stomping his foot. Or he's yelling at the orchestra, and
Let me just say it differently. I have had very little experience with bad conductors or nasty conductors. They always seem to want to get along with you, and I think that's a natural thing. You're going to be making music together. I only had one experience with one conductor who was always screaming at the orchestra. I don't think that's a very good way to work with an orchestra. But for the most part, you get to know the conductor even for 15 minutes beforehand, and you can size each other up. And you want to get along well together. You want to communicate. You don't want to get up and not be able to make music together. So that's also one of the wonderful things about making music is doing it with different people. I have had to go into situations where you sit down with a string quartet and I don't even know the names of the people, and we have to rehearse and play a concert and I can't remember who the second violinist is. But you do make music together.
Does it make a difference whether you're playing with an orchestra or a string quartet?
Yes, you play differently because when you play with a string quartet, you want to blend in, etc. When I'm playing a Mozart concerto, I need to play like a soloist and make my own statement rather than being part of a statement.
Some classical musicians are known as a pain in the rear because they have writers and say they have to have a certain kind of grape in the green room when they get there. Are you one of those people?
Gosh, no. But I do know a wonderful story that happened at Wolf Trap because one of the producers told it to me about the business of having these riders that say you must have hot chicken ready for you, etc. There was a rider, and it came for a particular singer, and he said that he must have a special kind of masseuse there who will give him this special kind of thing, and a special kind of massage, and the producer was so angry, he just crossed it out. And when the guy came, he was so easy. He didn't ask for a massage or anything. He didn't want anything. And the producer said to him, can I ask you something? I saw in the writer, it said you had to have this special masseuse. And and the performer laughed, and he said, I put that in just so I know if someone has read the writer. I thought, that is brilliant. Yeah. But I have had, in Vail, I had someone who wanted to have her gown pressed and special food, etc. And she was a friend of mine, so I called her, and I said, you know, your writer, it's not going to happen. She said, okay. So, you know, often it is the managers who make an artist look bad.
So we are so pleased that you've made this time to do this. And you seem like a nice person. Is being nice part of your personality, or is it something you have to learn?
That's just impossible to answer because I feel so complimented. And I like to think I'm nice. I get angry. I'm a person. I have my ups and my downs. I just feel I'm very lucky. I have had a very lucky life. I have had things I've wanted to do, and I've done them. There are some that haven't worked out. I've kept really busy, I realize, how busy I've been. I'm someone who needs to be that way. I try to be respectful and nice and kind because I expect that of my children. And I think that's, we were talking about parenting earlier on. I think when you have children, you have to always have in the back of your mind, behave the way your children are going to see this. You have to behave in a way that will be a pattern for them. Okay. So thank you for saying I'm nice. Well, you're nice too, Alan.
No, people don't think that at all. Can't have that going around. So really quickly, I'm a political scientist, and I spend most of my time on politics. Are you a political person?
I am political in that, sure, I'm an American, and I'm really upset about this election, just like all the other Americans. Yeah. And I don't know what will happen. I simply hope that we don't make a terrible, terrible mistake. I do think we're lucky that we have time to for things to kind of settle down. And I do hope that America can make a choice that will be able to put us back on a good track. I know a story about a friend whose kid was at college in UCLA, and all the kids were together as it became clear who had won the election. And one kid got up and shouted, "We don't suck anymore." And I thought, I would like to, at the end of this election, be able to say we don't suck anymore.
Our guest has been Eugenia Zuckerman, and what a pleasure it's been to have you here. And we're out of time. We've been talking to Eugenia Zuckerman, celebrated flutist, flautist, floatist, and new music director of Clarion Concerts and Columbia County's Leafpeeper Concerts. I urge everybody to go. Eugenia, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.